Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Now, a conversation with controversial reporter Jeff Gannon is coming up, but first. Rescue crews look for survivors after a massive bomb explosion shattered the peace in downtown Beirut this morning, killing a former Lebanese prime minister. The blast created a 30-foot crater in the street. At least 10 people were also killed and more than 100 injured. The attack targeted the motorcade of Rafik Hariri, a billionaire who helped rebuild Lebanon as prime minister. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large and a syndicated columnist based at the English-language Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. Rami, first of all, this sounds like a powerful explosion.
Well, it was. It was just a massive bomb, and I was sitting about a mile away from it in my office, and it shook the windows. And my family at home, which is probably about 2 miles away, they heard it and shook their windows too. So it was just an extraordinary operation, which obviously professionally done, not just a bunch of freelance terrorists.
Well, let's put Mr. Hariri in some sort of historical context. He came to the prime minister role in 92, just 2 years after Lebanon's brutal 15-year civil war ended. Why did he leave office, and why might he have been targeted?
Hariri was really the symbol of reconstruction of Lebanon. He came back and became prime minister and led an extraordinary rebuilding effort, physical and political. And he was very much the symbol of that. And that's possibly one reason why he was targeted.
Well, tell us more about that.
Well, it's hard to tell who would have done this. The problem with these things in Lebanon in particular, unfortunately, is that there's probably half a dozen credible candidates for who would have done this. I mean, whoever did this wanted to destabilize Lebanon. This was not just a revenge killing. I mean, this was a professional job. The impact of this is going to be to shake a lot of people's confidence in Lebanon. And you're going to hear all kinds of accusations against internal groups, against the Syrians, against foreign parties, against Israel, against people in the government who are against Hariri, various rivals politically. There's going to be lots and lots of accusations and speculation. Hopefully there will be some kind of serious investigation that might be able to find out who actually did it. That's probably going to be unlikely to come up with a definitive answer. But the target, Hariri was the immediate target. The bigger target was the stability of Lebanon.
We understand that Mr. Hariri resigned as prime minister after parliament amended the constitution to extend the Syrian-backed president's term by 3 years, and that there is a schism now between those who back Syria's current presence in the country with thousands of troops and those who want Syria out. Where did he stand?
He was more and more with the people who were critical of the Syrian presence in the country and the extension of President Lahoud's term. That created a big groundswell of protest, and more people were speaking out against the presidential extension, against the forces that supported the presidential term extension here in Lebanon and against those in Syria and outside who supported that.
Well, Rami Khoury, Rafik Hariri was also a friend of the U.S. We're speaking from the grounds of Boston University. He was a member of the Board of Trustees here. There's a huge school of management in his name. He's donated quite a bit of money to the school. Do you think his relations with the U.S. might have made him a target?
I kind of doubt it, because there's an awful lot of other people who had a lot less security around them who are close to the U.S., and there's many, many other targets. If somebody wanted to send a message to the U.S., they would have been many, many easier targets to go after.
What impact will this bombing today have on the region? Lebanon has been relatively quiet.
Be a negative impact. Initially, it'll cause people to be more scared and more concerned, more fearful and worried. Already today in Beirut, people closed up their shops early and went home. And the thing about Hariri, unlike many other Lebanese politicians, is he wasn't a traditional warlord or militia leader. He didn't have his own militia. So it's not the kind of situation that automatically is going to bring about a revenge bombing or a revenge killing.
Rami Khoury is editor-at-large and syndicated columnist based at the English-language Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. Rami, thanks as always.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
T. Two Democratic lawmakers are calling for an investigation into how a reporter for a non-news website had access to highly classified material outing CIA agent Valerie Plame. Well, others are continuing to ask about the reporter, whose real name is James Guckert, but wrote under the name Jeff Gannon on the Republican-backed website TalonNews.com, and always seemed to ask softball partisan questions, including this one at the president's most recent press conference.
Thank you. Senate Democratic leaders have painted a very bleak picture of the U.S. economy. Harry Reid was talking about soup lines, and Hillary Clinton was talking about...
Well, the problem is, Harry Reid, Ned, said no such thing. We'll speak to a member of the White House press corps in a moment, but last week we spoke to Gannon, who says he quit his job at Talon News after being hounded by left-wing bloggers. We began by asking about the highly classified Plame documents, which in the past Gannon boasted about having access to.
That's not something that I'm able to discuss.
Well, you discussed it on your website.
Let me say this about this memo that's being discussed. When I say accessible, I am talking about the information contained therein.
Well, and now, as you well know, there are two New York Times reporters who are facing jail sentences for not revealing their sources regarding the name of Valerie Plame, and they didn't even comment on it or print anything about it. So has any...
No, that's terrible. That's unfortunate.
Well, has anyone from the Plame investigation contacted you?
Yes.
And?
I really can't speak to that. Yeah. And as a journalist, it would be wrong to do that.
You say as a journalist, and some would say that you're not a journalist, that you have no credentials other than writing for TalonNews.com, which is run by a Texas Republican operative named Robert Eberle, and that it's more a PR arm of the GOP than any kind of a news service.
This was an independent news organization. I took no editorial direction. No one prompted me for my questions. I write about abortion. I write about family values issues. I write about judicial nominees.
And as you well know, your critics say that rather than write, you actually just take huge portions of White House or GOP press releases and put them on the site.
You know, my beat has been the White House for the last 2 years. And I represent what the White House said on a certain issue. And I use information from and verbiage from White House press releases. That's why the press office puts it out there. Anybody reading my articles get an unvarnished version of what the White House believes or their position on a certain issue.
But your critics say that's what a PR flack does. A journalist's job is to question any president. Now, you've been writing for TalonNews.com for 2 years, you said?
For 2 years, and I've written over 500 articles.
And
how long do I have to do this before I'm to be considered a journalist?
Well, it brings us back to a couple of the other questions. Can you understand why some would say you've only written for 2 years for a Republican-backed blog? You've had no previous reporting experiences. Why were you shown sensitive material regarding a CIA agent?
Well, I can understand how somebody asked that question, but one had nothing to do with the other. I did good work. I pursued a story, and I got a great interview with Ambassador Wilson. I should get an award for that.
How did you get White House press credentials?
I didn't have White House press credentials. There's a hard pass, which are permanent White House press credentials. But journalists who don't have a hard pass can apply for a daily pass. You know, I gave them my real name. Of course, we know that I write under a synonym or a pseudonym, Social Security, et cetera, so they can do a cursory background check. They put you in the computer. You go to the guard station outside the White House. You show your picture ID, in this case my driver's license, and you get in.
And this was with the name James Guckert?
Yeah, James Guckert is my real name. Yeah. And I'm not the only journalist there that has a name that's other than what's on the driver's license.
No, I was just asking for security reasons, and you said they were fully aware of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is the part I like. For security reasons, if you believe that I'm a plant and a shill, I'm the person that poses the least risk to anybody inside the White House.
What do you think about the thoughts that you are a plant?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely, completely, and totally inaccurate. I've met the president exactly twice at White House Christmas parties given for the media, and I'm sure he probably knows who I am now, but even at the time he called on me, I don't believe he knew who I was.
Have you ever talked to anybody in the White House? Have you ever talked directly to Scott McClellan or anyone else in the White House about asking the president questions?
No.
No one?
No. That day, he had called, he had answered already 45 questions before he pointed to me.
Well, and then you know the criticism is that he pointed to you right after he'd been heavily grilled and that you had a softball for him, which leads to the thinking that that was your job, to lob a softball at the president.
Well, I'm sure that that's not the case. You know, to say that he was, you know, looking for a lifeline, he doesn't even know who I am.
Well, did you know at the time that there was complete fiction in your question, that Harry Reid had never mentioned soup lines, and speaking of the economy, that that was a joke that Rush Limbaugh made up?
Well, if I had said, it was a poorly worded question, I concede that. If I had said Harry Reid described the U.S. economy as if there were soup lines, that would have been accurate.
What do you do now if you were being paid, I'm assuming, you're not doing this for free, you were being paid by a Republican operative to write for a website.
I was being paid by a news service to write news articles, and that's what I did.
A news service that was owned by a Republican operative. But what do you do now?
I don't know what I do now. I hope that my resignation will stop the threats against my family. We all in the profession and have to be concerned about that.
Let's ask you about that, because some of these bloggers that have investigated you after it was revealed that you might have had less than conventional journalistic credentials discovered that you had connections to websites devoted to gay sex.
About 5 years ago, I had a company that did website development. I had private client who wanted us to register these sites and develop the website. So it was like, well, this isn't a good idea. Nothing was ever put on those sites, and I can't even respond to all of it because I don't even know all of it. So I'm just saying, all right, even if the worst thing you say about me is true, so what?
On the other side, the criticism was that the website you work for, TalonNews.com, has in the past been critical of what it's called a homosexual agenda. So the feeling was that your connection with those sites, in whatever way it was hypocritical.
Well, this was one of the major issues in the campaign. I covered it for the White House, and I accurately reflected the administration's position on the issue of gay marriage, also what some of the family values people were saying.
But again, journalists aren't supposed to write for a White House. So one last question. Were you ever paid by the White House?
Absolutely not.
Have you ever been paid by anyone in the Bush administration?
Absolutely not.
Have you been paid by the Republican Party?
Absolutely not.
Even though the owner of your website is a member of the Republican Party, you don't view it that way.
Absolutely not. I have no political ties whatsoever, and that's more than any of my colleagues can say.
Jeff Gannon, speaking to us from Washington, D.C., thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Jeff Gannon also goes by the name James Gugert. He says he's quit his job at the website TalonNews.com last week because of pressure from left-leaning bloggers. Well, just ahead, a White House correspondent who sat with Jeff at news conferences for the past 2 years, how is the press corps feeling about the partisan among them? There's more coming up here and now. Young, it's here and now with more of our conversation about Jeff Gannon, who for 2 years attended White House press conferences for the questionable journalism site TalonNews.com. Their mission is to support conservative causes and the Republican Party. Joining us on the line now, Bob Deans, a White House correspondent for Cox Newspapers and a former president of the White House Correspondents Association. And Bob, you sat next to Jeff Gannon in news conferences. How did he strike you?
I liked Jeff. He was a nice guy. He was always a gentleman. As you say, we sat together almost every day for the better part of 2 years. My issue has never been personal with Jeff, but that I don't think partisanship belongs in that briefing room.
Did you feel, by the way, backing up just a bit, did you feel that he was a real reporter?
You know, we don't tend to make those kinds of judgments. I never inquired as to what is Talon News. I just assumed he was there doing his job like the rest of us.
Well, and as you watched him doing his job, did you get a sense, as others did over the last couple of years, that he was a partisan reporter?
I did. I thought that most of the questions he asked were not designed to elicit information, but designed to assert some point of view on camera as these briefings are covered on air, and that was the problem I had.
Yeah, and Bob, just taking a second on that, I've been speaking to a lot of young people in particular about this, and there's great cynicism out there. There are people who say, yeah, so doesn't everyone do that?
Yeah, and that's an important point. Of course not. Everyone doesn't do that. The vast majority of those of us who are in that briefing room every day are there because we want to hold the administration accountable to the public, and we want to ask questions to develop information on behalf of the public. Nobody needs a reporter in there asking the president, gee, aren't you a great guy, and aren't those Democrats terrible people? No, that's not our role. Our role is there to challenge the president, to look at the problems behind the promises of their policies.
And any president?
Any president, Democrat or Republican, and of course they all feel that there's a partisan nature that's biased against them. That's the nature of the relationship. It is somewhat adversarial. But certainly Bill Clinton felt that way. You remember people talking about the vast right-wing conspiracy that was out to get him. That's the nature of an adversarial relationship, which is what we're supposed to be doing.
Now, are there many other obviously partisan journalists such as Jeff Gannon at White House news conferences? Did he stick out like a sore thumb?
Yes, he did stick out. No, there are not. This is not a group of partisan reporters.
Well, isn't there a left-leaning reporter who writes on corporate crime?
Yes, there is. That individual comes in and he asks principally fact-based questions. Again, I don't know that I would call him partisan. Maybe others would disagree, but his questions tend to be based on fact. They're tough. Sometimes Scott thinks they're beyond the pale, and he won't respond to them.
But what about the notion that Jeff Gannon was a plant?
I never saw any evidence or indication to suggest as much. I think I've talked to Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, about it. I'm convinced that they saw him as another journalist like the rest of us and wanted him to have access, which is what we want.
What are your thoughts about the fact that Jeff Gannon says that he had special access to confidential documents that named undercover CIA agent Valerie Plame? There's an investigation going on. He says he was called before the investigation. This is a federal crime to leak an agent's name. Why would White House officials, knowing that, leak it to someone with such dubious professional credentials?
It's hard for me to assess that. I don't know if he got them firsthand, secondhand. I don't know that he, in fact, had it. I just don't know the facts on it.
Well, but we do know that he gained access to these day passes, these White House daily press credentials. He's explained that he just showed his license, which had his real name, not his professional name, and had a very cursory background check and was allowed in. Is that really how it works?
The way it works on the dailies is you call in there, and if the press office clears you and you don't have a press pass, then you show them at the gate some identification. And if you're in their computer system, they'll clear you in there. That's how he was doing it. Now, the way most of us work is we apply for a hard pass, and we're subject to a very rigorous FBI background check. It takes weeks, usually months, before we're issued a hard pass. Jeff did not apply for that hard pass and was getting in there, as you say, on a daily pass.
And as we know, his application for a congressional press pass was turned down.
That's right. Press credentialing is done differently at the White House from on Capitol Hill. On Capitol Hill, there is the Correspondents' Standing Committee, and the correspondents themselves decide who gets credentialed. At the White House, we don't do it that way. The White House Press Office makes those decisions. Now, the White House Correspondents' Association can weigh in if someone is troublesome or we have legitimate concerns. That never happened in the case of Jeff Gannon.
Will they now, in light of Jeff, raise it for future passes?
You know, Robin, I wouldn't expect this to cause any real change in the way we do business. I guess if someone else came in there for Talon News and started doing what Jeff did, people would scratch their heads. But the correspondents are very uneasy, pointing fingers, trying to pick and choose who belongs in that room, because at the end of the day, we want a free and unfettered press in there, and we're willing to go along with a lot of what we would regard as maybe, you know, not exactly what we would like to see in there, as opposed to cracking down on people and picking and choosing who belongs. That's just not a role we've ever been comfortable with.
But what about issues of safety? Putting politics aside, one would think the White House would be more concerned about who was in that room asking questions of the president.
Well, I do think on that score, we leave that strictly to the Secret Service. They monitor who's in and out, and if they have reason to be concerned, they'll take action on that.
Mm. And just one last thought, Bob Deans, former president of the White House Correspondents' Association. Again, with so much cynicism out there. How chilling has this been for your business?
Well, I think you put your finger on the problem. The public has a hard time, survey after survey shows, figuring out who to trust with the news. We feel like when they're watching a White House news briefing, the public has a right to know that we are who we say we are, that we are not in there with a political partisan axe to grind one way or the other, left or right, and that we're going to report it straight up, and that if we don't, our editors will get us out of there. The public has a right to know those things about us, and when you have people in there who are clearly partisan, it taints all of us.
And for those who would say this is just the media elite turning their nose up at a blogger, it was the bloggers that uncovered Jeff Gannon.
That's correct. It was kind of a live by the blog, go by the blog.
Bob Deans is a White House correspondent for Cox Newspapers and a former president of the White House Correspondents Association. Bob, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, Malcolm Gladwell, the author of The Tipping Point, now talks about his new bestseller, Blink. Do you really know everything you need to know about a person or a product in the first 2 seconds you see them? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The homeless man who once sued a library in New Jersey for kicking him out is in the news again. In 1991, Richard Kramer won $230,000 after a federal judge ruled that libraries could not ban otherwise well-behaved homeless people, no matter how they dressed or smelled. Well, now Richard Kramer is considering another lawsuit, this time against the New Jersey transit system for kicking homeless people out of train and bus stations. And once again, he's got the American Civil Liberties Union on his side. Richard Kramer joins us now online from a payphone at a restaurant in South Orange, New Jersey. And Richard, your lawyer is currently talking with the transit system about revising its rules. In your opinion, what's the transit system doing wrong?
New Jersey Transit Police throughout the state have been having a policy of removing homeless people and poor people from their outdoor parks and recreational areas mm-hmm. outside their train and light rail and bus facilities, even if they've had tickets, even if they were well-behaved. They come up and they threaten homeless people with arrest and tell them that they're under arrest, but then tell them that they won't be prosecuted as long as they don't return to the property. Mm-hmm. And as what's happened with me over 50 times in the last 2 years, I've been questioned every time I go through a train station as a ticket passenger every time. I've been questioned as to why I'm there, what I'm doing there. I've been patted down. I've been searched. I've been asked if I'm homeless, where I'm going, and for no probable cause at all. So New Jersey Transit has not come up with any new criminal code of conduct at all. Mm.
So you think homeless people were being targeted, but some in the transit system have said that they have rules that people can't disrobe, bathe in the bathrooms, spit, drink alcohol, panhandle, block access to seats, and transit police can use their personal discretion to remove someone, and the ACLU, they're hoping to get that changed with the transit authority. But can you understand, Richard, that there are people who may not want to be confronted with people who are sleeping on benches or who are spending longer times in places like bus stations because it's their shelter? they feel that those people should be in shelters and not in the middle of their commute.
Well, you know, your question is well founded in theory, but the problem is, on numerous occasions, I've seen grandmothers and grandfathers bring their grandchildren in the train stations for hours at end, watching trains come in and depart, and they're not taking the trains, and they're not asked to leave. Well, if a homeless person is just browsing around in a store or a shop or a restaurant inside one of New Jersey Transit's seven major train stations, as long as they're peacefully engaged in peaceful conduct, they shouldn't be treated any differently.
Yeah. Richard, you've been pretty adamant about this, and you've followed this, as we mentioned, in different ways, targeting the New Jersey Library and now the transit system. In fact, one transit worker who didn't want to be named said in the New York Times that, Richard, you're the kind of person who will turn nice suburban liberals into conservatives real quick.
I've only been homeless 15 out of my 55 years. The other 40 years, whether it was Colorado or New Jersey, I've been a worker and a homeowner. And when I see something wrong, I try and correct that problem. Hmm. This was not just accidental. This was deliberately planned.
And what would you say, Richard, to people who said yes, and that's a good thing?
Well, first of all, Robin, your questions are very good. But let me just say this to you. There are no criminal loitering laws in New Jersey, first of all, that they could be breaking, because there's none that exist other than drugs and prostitution. Mm. So they're not breaking any laws that are currently on the books. Number two, the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal courts have basically struck down anti-loitering laws in other cases, even though this case may be a landmark because there's certain unique characteristics about it. But I understand your point, but let me just say this to you. There's nothing more unpopular in society than poor people and homeless people. But you have to protect them. If you don't protect them and give them the same due process, then there's no sense of having a constitution. Hmm. So, what are you going to do? You're going to put them in a boxcar and ship them off to Nebraska, you know, the way, that happened in World War II with some other people? Life's not fair, and you have to tolerate things.
Well, by the way, Richard, as we said, you got $230,000 in damages and settlements from your town, Morristown. So why are you homeless?
Number one, I got lawyered. And when I mean I got lawyered, that means that my team of lawyers and my experts ended up getting more than half of the $230,000. Most people think I got it all, but I did not. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, as soon as I got the money and I moved to the Boulder, Colorado area and lived out there for 8.5 years, which was like paradise on earth, by the way, that money, even though despite the fact that I was working, I had no health insurance for the last 11 years, and I came down with some very serious medical conditions without health insurance, and the remaining part of that money was eaten up by medical expenses because my job gave me no insurance. And that is the one question that everybody asks me, wherever I go across the United States, you got all that money, didn't you, Richard? And the reality is, Robin, I got a small percentage of that money after the lawyers, and certainly after the lack of health insurance over the past decade, which I think most Americans can relate to.
Where do you live now?
I spend my days in Morristown, and I spend my nights different places, including New York Penn Station, and I'm going to be entering politics pretty soon.
And what did you do when you had a job, Richard?
Oh, I had lots of jobs. My family owned a distributing paper product company. I drove a truck. I worked in a warehouse. I trained horses. I worked for an electrician company. I painted. I did landscaping. When I was in Colorado, I worked as a sales manager, and I was employee of the year for 5 years. And then I moved back to Woodbury, New Jersey, in South Jersey, in the year 2000, and I was living on Section 8, and I lost that due to budget cuts, and that's how I ended up being on the streets again.
Richard Kramer is homeless and spends much of his time in the New Jersey transit system. He's considering suing the agency for kicking homeless people out of stations. Richard, thanks for telling us about it.
Thank you.
And still to come, musical Valentines will look at love songs sent from one artist to another. You're listening to Here and Now. Do not go gentle into that good night. Come on down. You're on The Price is Right. That was our first thought when we heard there was a poetry game show. The poetry game show takes place on the second Monday of every month at the Bowery Poetry Club in New York City. In fact, there's one tonight. MC Douglas Rothschild reads the first line of a famous poem, and everyone has to guess who wrote it. Here now's Sean Cole, attended a recent show and brings us this story.
All righty, welcome to the Bowery Poetry Club, where we have the Poetry Game Show. Yeah. What thoughts have I of you tonight, Walt Whitman?
Ella Ginsberg.
Very good. Reggie Cabico.
Reggie Cabico is the on-stage contestant. It's him against the audience. Whoever gets the most points wins. Meantime, anyone who gets an individual answer right is awarded an item from the heap of sumptuous prizes Douglas bought at a 99-cent store in Brooklyn, such as a
glow-in-the-dark inflatable ball.
There's only a handful of people in the crowd tonight, scattered around in the folding chairs facing the stage or sitting at the bar. Douglas says when he first came up with the idea, there were only three participants, him and the poet Jennifer Moxley and the critic Steve Evans.
We'd all grabbed selective volumes of poetry, and we're sort of reading poems to each other. And Steve read something, and I was like, what was that? And then I was like, wait, don't tell me. And I guessed, Rex Roth, Kenneth Rex Roth. And Steve laughed, and no, it was Theodore Ruthke or something. So then we just sort of started this competition.
I'll give the title. In Memory of Radio?
Woody Allen,
no. And
but Guess That Poet is a hard game to sustain for an hour in a bar. So Douglas came up with a few other literary challenges for the show.
Our most popular game is Caption That Slide. Kathy Hannon of the Found Slide Foundation shows slides that she has found, and then the audience looks at the slide and tries to think of famous line of poetry or a famous quotation or a line from a novel that would go with a particular slide.
The picture, for those listening on the radio, was a man with lovely 70s curly hair and a piercing blue gaze in nothing but a jock strap, which he's slowly removing with a jungle background. Reggie, your first line.
A narrow fellow in the grass.
A narrow fellow in the grass. And what is that, Dylan Thomas?
That's Emily Dickinson.
Emily Dickinson, a narrow fellow in the grass. Yeah.
Over the course of the hour, the audience grows by more than half, which is impressive, until I realize that a lot of the newcomers are just there to see the band that's going on after the show. Still, everyone seems to be having a great time, which makes it all the more frustrating for Douglas when his poet friends say they don't want to come.
They're like, well, I don't really like that kind of thing. And I'm like, what do you mean that kind of thing? Nothing like this has ever happened anywhere, ever. How could you not like that kind of thing? Like, oh yeah, I've been to poetry game shows, and yeah, they're just not my cup of tea.
The wheel of cheese upon the floor.
You know, it's not medicine. Poetry can be medicinal, but it doesn't have to taste bad. You know, people like spearmint tea. It's good for you, too, right? good for your digestion, but you like it. It's enjoyable. So that I want poetry to be that. Enjoyable and good for you. Many poets seem to give readings, and I don't know exactly what they're trying to present, you know, but they don't really make it enjoyable.
What's our score?
Audience 7, Reggie 5.
Audience 7, Reggie 5. One more poem.
In the end, the audience squeaks by with a win. Douglas hurriedly gathers his things and gets off the stage so the band can set up. A few minutes later, he's out on the sidewalk thanking folks for coming and telling them not to miss the next event, when the theme will be
love poems.
Yeah.
Because the next event is today, Valentine's Day.
We'll be there.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye.
Our visit to the Poetry Game Show at the Bowery Poetry Club in New York City was produced by Sean Cole. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. It's here and now. The late Ray Charles led the pack of Grammy Award winners last night, garnering 8 awards, including Album of the Year for Genius Loves Company, a CD of duets with artists including Elton John, Willie Nelson, and Bonnie Raitt. His duet with Norah Jones, Here We Go Again, won Record of the Year and Best Pop Collaboration.
God bless Ray Charles.
Yeah.
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 It was such an honor for me to get to meet him and sing with him and actually just watch him sing from 2 feet away. It was amazing.
Other multiple winners included U2, Loretta Lynn for her generation-bending CD with producer Jack White, who groveled before the country legend at the awards podium, and Usher, who won a Grammy for his rap song, Yeah. Also during last night's Grammy Awards, newlyweds Jennifer Lopez and Marc Anthony sang Escape Among Us to each other, interpreted by their fans as a sign of marital bliss. Well, on this Valentine's Day, we thought we'd take a look at how musicians send musical smoke signals to other musicians, often without our knowing. Here in Oz, pop music critic Tim Riley joins us now. And Tim, over the years, couples, you know, in country and western have had the strongest tradition of lovers singing to one another. George Jones and Tammy Wynette, Porter Wagoner, Dolly Parton. But in rock and roll, it's, I don't know, it seems more coded. What happened?
Well, rock came along and sort of turned the tables on everybody. Rock wasn't that interested in how sweet and constant love was going to be. Rock had a very individualistic rebel streak. It was very much about the individual, and it was very interested in more the complications of love and how difficult love could be and all the hurdles that you had to get through.
Although I'm thinking of one example in country where there was a not-so-coded song written by June Carter, her love for Johnny Cash, even while he was married.
Right.
Ring of Fire.
Ring of Fire, very famous example.
The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. Went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns.
The rock equivalent of that would have been Eric Clapton singing to Patty Harrison, who was his good friend George Harrison's wife, and he writes this agonized plea for this woman's love in the song Layla, which is a classic love song now in the blues vein. And they later, of course, George Harrison did a rendition of Bye Bye Love, the Everly Brothers song, for that relationship that broke up because Clapton wound up stealing Patty Harrison away from George, and he sings Bye Bye Love about it, trying to be light about it.
See how complicated it gets? And this is where this segment turns into Robin is just looking for another opportunity to play her favorite song of all time. It's Joni Mitchell's Case of You.
That's right.
Which was written for?
Graham Nash. She would have known Graham Nash through his bandmate David Crosby, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And David Crosby gets a big credit for producing Joni Mitchell's first album, bringing her to the label. And she strikes up a romance with Graham Nash, and this song, Case of You, is about Graham Nash.
You're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could drink. Of you, darling, and I would still be on my feet. Oh, I would still be on my feet.
Joni Mitchell's Case of You, written for Graham Nash, who reciprocates.
Well, a lot of these figures play on each other's records. At Crosby, Stills, and Nash were close to Mitchell, and they would show up at sessions for her. On another record of hers, For the Roses, Graham Nash winds up playing harmonica on one of my favorite songs of hers, You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio. And apparently, he writes Our House for Joni Mitchell, even though they were never married.
It's just an ideal. That they
two cats in the yard. You know, you don't need to get married to have two cats in the yard, I guess.
While we're playing trivia here, which is what this becomes, didn't Steve Stills sing about Judy Collins with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Sweet Judy Blue Eyes?
That's right.
I am yours, you are mine, you are what you are, you make it hard.
Let's look for other hidden messages in rock and roll, shall we? And update it a little bit. Courtney Love.
Well, Courtney Love, of course, the famous widow of Kurt Cobain. She's infamous 10 years ago. And now she sits on her punk throne as the ironically self-dubbed America's Sweetheart, which is last year's record. And she finds that she's one of the older women at the party. And so she writes this wonderful song about dating Julian Casablancas from The Strokes. And the song is called But Julian, I'm a Little Old for You.
Courtney Love's But Julian, I'm a Little Old for You, written for the lead singer of The Strokes. When you start to think about who singers might be singing to, you have to think of Sheryl Crow.
Right. Well, Sheryl Crow does a lot of duets and a lot of tribute records. And apparently one of the earliest big songs she wrote that was towards another famous person was You're My Favorite Mistake, which is from that Globe Sessions record, wonderful record. And apparently that's about Eric Clapton, because she used to sing backup for him, and apparently they had a thing. The other record that I really like from Sheryl Crow is the duet she did with Kid Rock, which is a song called Picture, which is quite appropriately a very country and western-tinged record, and a very, very nice duet between these two.
You reminded me of brighter days.
I hoped you were coming home to stay. I was headed to church.
I was off to drink you away.
Sheryl Crow and Kid Rock singing about breakups, although they were not a couple. They didn't have one. But, Tim, it seems that she is comfortable singing about her breakup, so I'm thinking that Lance Armstrong should keep that in mind. They're, of course, dating now. He's the cyclist.
He should look out. There may be a song in there for him. There is this funny thing that goes on with pop stars that Neil Young talks about in that biography that came out, which is you know that if you have this big breakup and you write an album about it, you know it's going to be a big hit. So there's always a lot of tension in these famous people's relationships because they understand there's great material there if it gets really torrid and heads south, you know.
Some of them have never, you know, their lips are sealed. Carly Simon, I don't think, she still hasn't said who You're So Vain is about.
Well, everyone knows that's about Warren Beatty.
And James Taylor wrote Used to Be Her Town,
too. Used to Be Her Town. That's about The Vineyard and breaking up with Carly Simon. It used to be her town, yeah. But then, of course, you have the other extreme where Fleetwood Mac, where they're all married, and then they get really famous, and then they break up, they get divorced, and they have to produce a follow-up record. So they produce Rumors, which becomes the biggest-selling record of all time up to that point. And it's all these breakup songs, and they have to stay in the same band with these people you used to be married to.
Singing about them.
Yeah, I mean, that's just so Hollywood. What could be more Hollywood?
Well, Tim Riley, I guess the moral of the story this Valentine's Day is if you're pining for someone or you've had a terrible breakup, write a song about it.
Okay.
Here now is pop critic Tim Riley.
Listen to the wind blow, watch the sun rise. Running in the shadows, damn your love, damn your life.
Here now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Happy Valentine's Day, despite the sentiment here. Join us again, here and now.
I can still hear you saying.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin.